Welcome to Let's Just Talk. I'm your host, Tommy. Tensions are once again escalating between India and Pakistan, the two nuclear-armed neighbors, following a deadly attack on April 22nd in Indian-administered Kashmir that left 26 tourists dead. And New Delhi instantly blamed its neighbor for the attack, but Islamabad has denied any involvement. India launched a series of 9 airstrikes across Pakistan, reportedly killing at least 31 civilians. Joining us to unpack what is at stake is Dr. Amar Ali Jan, a historian, organizer, and the general secretary for the party, the People's Rights Party, Haku Kehal.
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah, in Pakistan. Dr. Ali Jan, welcome to this Just Talk. We're excited to have you here. We want to start with the current crisis, right? The attacks in Kashmir pushed India and Pakistan into a familiar pattern of accusation, brinksmanship, and military posturing. Indian officials blaming Pakistan and Pakistan officials denying any involvement and demanding evidence, rightfully so. So what is your read of the current escalations between the two nations?
Thank you for having me. Right now, as we speak, a number of cities have been hit in Pakistan once again. Yesterday, India, as you rightly pointed out, attacked 9 cities. Now, what is unprecedented about this current situation is that not only was there this tension in Kashmir, which is a disputed territory that we will talk about, which is under brutal colonial occupation, but for the first time since 1971, there was also conflict on the permanent international border. So the city of Bahawalpur was attacked, the city of Muridke was attacked, and there was a lot of panic yesterday, a lot of confusion, a lot of fear. Now, India was also using French planes, the Rafale, so it's very much, you know, as always, Europe is at the heart of every problem in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, today, the attack by India was a drone strike. There were drones that were used in the attack, and mm-hmm. these were Israeli drones. So this is, again, a new kind of a situation where you have the collaboration between India and Israel that is also threatening the region. Moreover, with Israel destroying all remnants of international law during its continued genocide in Gaza, It has emboldened a lot of right-wing regimes across the world. If Israel can do it, why can't we do it? And it seems like India will keep escalating. And India has a constituency, the current government, right-wing government of Narendra Modi. His constituency has been constructed in such a way that they want more war. They want more violence. Mm-hmm. That is how he wins elections. Hatred of Pakistan, hatred of Muslims. And what we've seen since the 22nd of April is absolute belligerence on the side of the Indian government. I mean, I'm no fan of the Pakistani government either. I have a sedition case against me from the Pakistani state, which carries a life sentence. So, wow. You know, I'm fighting that and I'm resisting the Pakistani state in all kinds of draconian measures that it uses against our people. However, on this point, the Pakistani state has been reasonable. After this attack on the 22nd of April in Pahalgam, Pakistan offered a joint investigation. After that, Pakistan offered that there could be an international investigation. But India decided to act as judge, jury, and now executioner. There was absolutely no appetite in India for any kind of negotiations. And this, by the way, has been the case for almost 10 years since the Modi regime came to power in India in 2014. And since 2016, there's been no kind of bilateral dialogue between India and Pakistan, while the situation not only between the two countries is deteriorating, but we must not forget the people of Kashmir, who are the biggest victims of this violence, not only at times from the side of Pakistan, but particularly on the side of India, The colonial occupation, the hundreds of thousands who've been killed, tortured, arrested in India, the blackout that appeared in Kashmir in 2019 when Article 370, which gave some kind of autonomy to Kashmiris, was revoked by the Modi regime. And the reason why there's so much hysteria in India right now is because the Modi regime constructed a narrative that after its brutal repression in 2019 in Kashmir, there was now normalcy and there's tourism now and everything is hunky-dory in the occupied territories. However, this incident, which particularly attacked tourists, has also shocked India, and it has kind of destroyed this narrative of normalcy that was being built around Kashmir. So we're in uncharted territory. We have no constituency, it seems like, no constituency for peace at the moment in our eastern neighbor. There's growing collaboration between India and Israel and the US. J.D. Vance was there recently, and they've signed a strategic partnership because they said US and Indian military interests converge, which basically means an anti-China strategy. And with the destruction of international law, I think there'll be more and more provocations from New Delhi.
Wow. There is so much to unpack in that, you know, intro editorial. It's been fascinating from like a Westerner perspective, someone who's not from the region, to also see the way in which the language of terrorism is adapted and used. The Cost of War Project has done an amazing job following the post 9/11 wars and how each one is reinforced, reignited, and, you know, sold to the masses through the lens of terrorism and combating terrorism. So it's been fascinating to see it be used also in that context. But since you brought it up, let's just touch on it right now. One of the most striking shifts in this crisis has been like India's decision to act without international consensus or presenting evidence. And this marks a departure from past patterns. And in past incidents, you've mentioned 2019. And there was also something in 2016 where, you know, India attempted to build a case for international legitimacy, such as inviting Pakistani investigators. But this time it perhaps has been under domestic pressure to just proceed with Operation Sindoor. And so, you know, what does this mean now for India's willingness to act unilaterally, even though the stakes are so high? And we're talking about two nuclear powers. And I think like for a lot of people in the West, they don't understand what that means. You know, that literally means Armageddon. And nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent, and both nations have it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The war on terror has a very sordid history all over the world. From its very beginning, it was a tool used by ruling classes to undermine international law. After 9/11, Pakistan was forced to become a frontline state in the war on terror. And Pakistan has a very peculiar history with terrorism. Because the Pakistani elites joined the US-led Afghan jihad in the 1980s. So we were also a frontline state when there was jihad being done. And back then, of course, President Reagan used to call the Mujahideen the moral equivalents of the founding fathers of the US. This is about Osama bin Laden and other nice folks like him who at that time had access to American dollars, who had access to American weapons, American training. And Pakistan was turned into a conduit for all those activities. And once America ended that war, they were able to defeat the socialist government in Afghanistan and the Soviet Union collapsed. America just left the region. But the region then had these entire networks of militancy. And, you know, we grew up watching a lot of violence inside Pakistan, in the region. There was a lot of weapons that there are still weapons are circulating from the 1980s. So by the time of 9/11, Pakistan already had these very strong militant networks that had been prepared by the CIA. And then Pakistan was asked to dismantle all of that and become a frontline state. And the resulting tensions led to the deaths of 70,000 Pakistani civilians, including the murder, the assassination of the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. So it's been a very, very difficult time for Pakistan. And the elites, of course, have milked it. They have used this war to undermine law, to make a lot of wealth for themselves. Right now in Pakistan, the top 1% own over 30% of the wealth, and a lot of it is connected to dollars coming from NATO's endless wars. On the other hand, actors like India, Israel, and even, now if you look at Kenya, you look at Rwanda, a lot of these countries who were looking at the international architecture being destroyed in front of their eyes, they were preparing for this. I mean, the Iraq war happened, the Libya war happened, the Syria war happened, the Yemen war happened. These were all wars that were illegal, that at times did collective punishment, that starved people, that destroyed entire nation states. And then the worst example, of course, we know is the ongoing genocide in Gaza. India has had its own war on terror moment, which again started in the 90s with this brutal repression of Kashmiri groups. And I'm sure you've spoken to some friends from Kashmir, and they can tell you details of the horrific violence exercised by the Indian military on Kashmiri people. And it's all been couched in this language of war on terror, which, remember, is one, a language that kind of tries to move beyond law. It exceeds the boundaries set by law. And second, it dehumanizes the others. In this particular case, Kashmiris, Muslims. So there's Islamophobia very much inbuilt in the entire war on terror discourse since 9/11. And India has used that with precision. The problem now is that the number of things have converged. One, as we've already said, it's the destruction, complete destruction of any remnants of international law. India is looking at that. Second, the decision of Biden and then Trump, by the way, this started with Obama, the decision to make India a frontline state in South Asia, a frontline state against China, basically, to counter China as a counter kind of counterweight, counter hegemon. That has also emboldened India a lot. They know they have access to US weapons, Israeli weapons, European weapons. And when that combines, these two things combined with an electoral calculus where the ruling party knows that war, hatred, tensions at the border, attacks across the border, that these are not simply tragedies, but they're also wonderful events for getting votes, for solidifying the electoral base of the party. This is the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is a far-right Hindu nationalist party, involved or accused, but also involved in destroying mosques, in committing riots, most famous ones being in Gujarat in 2002, where the then Chief Minister Narendra Modi was involved in the killing of at least 1,000 Muslims. And now he's been awarded or rewarded by becoming, the Prime Minister of India. So those riots, they actually don't hurt but help the electoral calculus of this party. So when these three things combine, the destruction of international law, the decision of Western powers, particularly DC, to turn India into a regional hegemon, and this electoral calculus of right-wing forces. This is a deadly combination, and this escalation that we're seeing in the subcontinent right now, it's stemming from this combination in India.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating, especially when, as you said so clearly, when going to war benefits those in power, and there is so many incentives around it, then you have no reason not to engage. You have no reason to engage in diplomacy and de-escalation and so on. I will spend a lot of time talking about occupied Kashmir, and like for you to steep us into the history a bit. But I wanted you to give us a little bit of background on the resistance front, which has claimed responsibility. You know, I was reading a report that they're connected to, that they're a proxy of LET, Lashkar-e-Taiba. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. What can you tell us about that? And, you know, all of the claims from India that they're connected to the Pakistani intelligence service and so on. Does that give this their actions any legitimacy?
This is not a well-known group. This is some new group. And Pakistan's claim is that Lashkar-e-Taiba, which no doubt once had connections with Pakistan, that it's been banned. Its leader has been sentenced, is serving a life sentence in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Pakistan's claim, of course, is that this group does not exist. Mm-hmm. Pakistan's narrative is that this could even be a false flag operation.
Right.
Whatever the case is, no mainstream freedom fighter mm-hmm. or militant group or political party has accepted responsibility or supported or celebrated these attacks. Mm-hmm. So this is not like 7th October, even in that sense, mm-hmm. In the sense that there was a large group of Palestinians who knew that this was an anti-colonial act, who defended it. And then, of course, there was a lot of people all over the world who were defending it. Mm-hmm. Here, there's nobody defending it.
Right.
So India really wants to create a fiction. It's thinking in terms of analogies. And it's really, really sickening, in my mm-hmm. opinion, that when you're drawing an analogy from the Middle East, you're mm-hmm. identifying not with the people of Gaza or the Lebanese or the Syrians or the Yemenis. You're actually trying to identify with Israel. And that's the kind of comparison mm-hmm. they're trying to create in their minds.
Right.
And I don't think it's worked. The world mm-hmm. didn't take them seriously. That's one of the reasons why there was a lot of frustration, because they really thought, if you look at the Indian media right now, mm-hmm. They were gloating after the 22nd that, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, they were hysterical, but also gloating about the fact that we've now received our 7th October, the opportunity to annihilate right. Kashmir, annihilate Pakistan. These like what we call Hindutva Zionist fantasies. This idea of annihilating the enemy, of collective punishment,
right.
This began right after these attacks. And right. it's important to remember that within a few hours, mm-hmm. India suspended the water treaty between India and Pakistan, which is the Indus Water Treaty. It's mm-hmm. an act of war. It's an act of collective punishment. And now mm-hmm. India wants to build all these hydro projects mm-hmm. on these waters that are part of this agreement that Pakistan and India reached in 1960, which was after 10 years of diplomacy mm-hmm. on which rivers could Pakistan use and which rivers India could use. And mm-hmm. now they're planning to build dams and other constructions on those rivers, which mm-hmm. means that it's an attempt to starve Pakistan. Right. Our agriculture, our even everyday life will become impossible. So this is very much a playbook. They're learning from the Israeli playbook very clearly. It's about creating a false narrative, which is mm-hmm. what happened after 22nd. It also happened after 7th October, misinterpreting the event, then creating this hysteria around a fiction, and then eventually punishing the other side based on that fiction. And the fact that Israeli drones are being used inside Pakistan right now just shows you the level of intimacy that these two countries have attained. You know, the intimacy between mm-hmm. India and Israel, which is I think a very important part of the dynamic that's taking yeah. place on the ground.
Thank you for breaking that down for us. And you'd mentioned earlier, you know, the Kashmiris, the most impacted people in all of this. Can you give us some historical backdrop that's necessary to understand today's tensions between the two nuclear armed nations?
Well, broadly speaking, it stems from the partition of India when the British were leaving India. Mm-hmm. That's when two countries were carved out, India and Pakistan, and now Bangladesh, which back in the day was, of course, part of Pakistan. So these three countries are the legacy of both the anti-colonial movement and its internal complications, internal ruptures, which eventually lead to a partition. There were a lot of disputes around the boundaries that were being set.
Yeah.
And Kashmir was in this unique situation. It was what we call a princely state. And there were a number of princely states across India. And in those states, the choice was given to the princely rulers on which side they would choose. In Kashmir, the problem was that the prince had lost legitimacy. And while he chose to side with India, the people revolted. And it became a dispute. We went to war in 1948. So in 1947, you have partition and independence. And in 48, you have a war over Kashmir. And a portion of Kashmir was occupied by India, and another portion was occupied by Pakistan. And since then, both countries have claimed that it is their territory, while Kashmiris have been demanding the right to self-determination.
Right.
The left, historically in Pakistan and India, has supported the right of self-determination of Kashmiris. However, we're seeing that large sections of the left now, at least in India, are kind of shying away from that position because of I assume it's because of the war hysteria that has been generated. Anyway, this situation remained tense for many decades. A lot of repression of Kashmiris. But in 1987, you have an election in Kashmir, which were believed to be widely rigged. This is Indian-held Kashmir, which then led to mass protests and police action, eventually military action, and the entire province went into a state of all-out rebellion. This is also the time when you have the Afghan jihad happening in Afghanistan. So you have a lot of weapons and training camps in Pakistan for militant troops. And there's that symbiotic relationship between those militants and some of the Kashmiris who were fleeing in the Indian side that develops in the late 80s and early 90s, due to which then India accuses Pakistan of fueling this this entire insurgency. However, the insurgents keep getting popular, their ranks keep getting filled by more and more young Kashmiris. And that's, I think, partly because of this history and the desire for freedom that the Kashmiris have, but also the brutal, brutal repression. If you read the reports of human rights organizations working in Kashmir on the kinds of methods that were being used by the Indian military, they're quite horrific. And I think that was one of the reasons why the Kashmiri insurgency kept becoming more and more popular. After the war on terror, Pakistan closed down all the camps. And I think that insurgency slowly started to lose steam. But the sentiment was still massive. The sentiment for independence, the sentiment for freedom. And I think one change that has happened over the last few years, maybe 5-10 years, is that by and large, a lot of young people in Kashmir were pro-Pakistan. But I think that has also changed because of the authoritarianism that we see inside Pakistan, because of the suppression of Kashmiris in Pakistan. I mean, it's not just Kashmiris. We have a very authoritarian state. So I think that's generally people are kind of fed up with the way Pakistan is being run. And a lot of young Kashmiris, it appears to me, that they have, they are now very, very convinced, if they weren't before, that they would want an independent state for the Kashmiri, for both sides.
Thank you so much. That was such a great analysis. And so, you know, just adding a little bit more color on what you said, Kashmir remains one of the most heavily militarized zones in the world. You know, read some report that since the 1990s, an estimated, you know, over 100,000 people have been killed. These are just things that we don't hear. You know, the revocation of Article 370, which stripped Kashmir of its special status, even triggering even deeper repression and demographic shifts. And so people under occupation usually don't acquiesce to their subjugation if history is a good teacher. But I want to move us on to geopolitics and external actors. You've mentioned several times that this is not just about India and Pakistan, and we're moving from a unipolar world order to a multipolar world order, with the US at the top, China as a close second, and Russia as a distant third. And regional powers are watching closely and some influencing these events. Could you tell us who might be positioning or advocating for India or Pakistan to act
Right.
in one way or another? What are the different strategic interests involved in these crises? Let's just stop
Yes.
there.
So historically, Pakistan has been in the Western camp. We were the most aligned or pro-US or pro-West country in the region. The ruling elites in the 1950s thought that India is a big military threat, and if we want to protect ourselves from India, but also get access to cheap dollars, then it's best to be in the American camp. This is the height of the Cold War. There's an anti-communist fervor in the US. This is the McCarthy era. And in 1953, 54, 55, Pakistan signs these military pacts with the US, which kind of brings it into the ambit of American power, and kind of eventually turns into a base for US activities in the region. They remember the US supported military dictators throughout Pakistan's history so that they could do their dirty work. And that's why there was mass repression against trade unionists, socialists, women's organizations, farmers' organizations. And this was not just happening in Pakistan. There was an entire architecture of military rulers that was created for a number of countries, for Indonesia, for Philippines, for Argentina, for
Nepal.
Brazil. And this was America's way of stopping the potential of decolonization in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. It was a counter-revolution on a global scale led by Washington, with the worst example, of course, being Jakarta, where thousands of people were killed, and of course Chile as well. And Pakistan is part of that story where military generals were used to do America's bidding in the region. Things shifted in the last few decades when America abandoned Pakistan. Even after 9/11, Pakistan became the frontline state, but tensions remained. There was a lot of mistrust on both sides. And Pakistan started gravitating towards China. And there's a longer history of Chinese-Pakistani cooperation, which kind of begins in the 1960s when China moves away from the Soviet Union. So there's a Sino-Soviet split that happens. And the Soviet Union was pro-India, so China sought allies in the region, and China went to war with India. So China eventually moved closer to Pakistan. Now, that was not historically a problem for Pakistan to be friends with both the US and China, particularly after Richard Nixon went to Beijing. This is now changing with the new Cold War, as you're mentioning, the multipolar world that's emerging, because America very much wants Pakistan to remain part of its camp, and to even reignite some kind of a jihad in Afghanistan, Central Asia, to block China from that side, from all the Muslim areas that are adjacent to China. On the other hand, the US has a number of bases across Asia, as you probably know. It's Philippines, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and then you have all these island bases as well. So they're surrounding China on that side as well. The total number of bases, according to one of the professors, David Vine, is 800. So 800 US military bases all over the world, and many of them located in Asia with China as the target. Then India, US sees as a major potential partner in this new fight, because India and China historically, as I said, they've been to war, they have a border dispute, they don't get along, and US feels that this fight can be exploited. These tensions can be exploited by turning India into a frontline state in the region. As I said earlier, counter-hegemon, a counterweight. And that would require not only investing a lot of money in India's economy, because it would be very hard for India to catch up to China, but also investing heavily in their military capacity. Now, if one country is increasing, ramping up its military capacity, against another country, in this case China, while that country is already surrounded by all these U.S. military bases, China will also ramp up its own defense mechanism. Yeah. And Pakistan, while watching all of this, for Pakistan, the problem would be that because its main security threat comes from India, it will also be left with no option but to spend more and more money on defense.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate that at a time when we should be talking about regional solutions, we should be talking about how do we deal with climate change, how do we deal with economic uncertainty after the tariffs, how should we deal with developing our economic indicators, social indicators, we are being forced into a position where all countries in South Asia will be spending their surplus on buying Western weapons. And one thing here I'll mention as well, there was kind of a proxy fight that happened yesterday between between the West and China in this fight, because the fighter jets that were being used by India were these were the Rafale, which are French fighter jets and considered to be the best jets. And Pakistan had J-17 with PL-15 missiles. And the idea in the global market, arms market, is that India had a huge advantage because the French are considered the best. But at least three of them were downed yesterday, which is the first time any French Rafales have been downed, which is causing a lot of excitement on Chinese social media. At the moment, because it's kind of a vindication of their technology. And this is J-17. They also have J-20. So Pakistan only has J-17. So they're feeling more confident. And there's a lot of this French intelligence official that was quoted by CNN, who said that there's a lot of anxiety and anger in France over the loss of these fighter jets, because that will depress the arms industry. It's bad publicity for the French arms industry. So the arms industry is watching all of this very closely, because Europe is about to rearm itself. So I think all of this is playing out, and unfortunately it's playing out on the bodies of the people of South Asia.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating. The arms industry has its arms everywhere. No pun intended, but you know, just to continue on that thread, if you're listening to realist scholars in the United States, right, it makes sense that they want to contain China by creating these islands around it. And what you understand also, like China's interest in aligning itself with Pakistan through like CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which will give them access to the Gwadar port, which provides China direct access to the Arabian Seas and circumvent the Malacca Straits, then you start to really see like the way geography is so important, and the placement of these two nuclear armed powers is also so important for these larger superpowers in terms of projecting their powers globally and across the globe. The question then remains, what comes next, right? Because what comes next for me has to depend on diplomacy, military restraint, and international pressure to calm things down. Both Pakistan and India are said to have about 170 arsenal nuclear warheads. I don't know if those numbers have changed or if the reports are correct, but when things look that meek, you really don't want to play with fire that much, you know? I mean, like, as you mentioned, both Modi and the General Asim in Pakistan benefit from these escalations. But then what does it mean for the global community? What does it mean for global safety? And where do we, I would like to get your insight on what might de-escalation look like, and what would it take for either country to walk back and engage in like peace talks, and also more importantly, the rights of Kashmiris, because you know sometimes we're so zeroed in on the bigger powers that we forget that at the center of it is the fundamental rights of everyday people on the ground who are the victims of all of these systems and powerful institutions.
Absolutely. I mean, you've created you've stated, I think, very clearly the stakes in all of this. These are two nuclear armed powers. So these are not ordinary third world armies. These are highly equipped destructive machines. The Pakistani military and the Indian military both have been mostly used against their own people. And that's where wars are profitable for them. It allows them to discipline internal populations. And, you know, war hysteria is the best moment when you can do that. On the other hand, I think for now, de-escalation, it's not going to be easy. I think there's a lot of anger now on the Pakistani side as well. I think we'll see a few tense days. However, there's always a lot of diplomacy happening in back through back backdoor channels. The US is also involved, China is involved, we also believe the European governments are involved. So there is hope that this will not be a catastrophic situation where God forbid we go through the absolute unthinkable, which is of course a nuclear war. But there is a lot of tension on both sides. There are a lot of grievances on both sides. I'm optimistic about a ceasefire at some point soon, if all actors play their cards rationally. But in such situations, you don't know whether war hysteria can make people act rationally or irrationally. So there's that fear. However, in the long run, I'm not very optimistic because of the because of the pacts between the US and India and the growing relationship between India and Israel, it's impossible, in my opinion, that this region will demilitarize, which is what's really needed in the long run. Demilitarization of the region, reorientation of our surplus resources on improving developmental indicators, ensuring that, for example, the 25 million children in Pakistan who don't go to school because they can't afford it, we should be sending them to school. We should be ensuring that the 40% of people who die because of bad water, they should get access to clean water. We're not talking about those things anymore. We're talking about this geopolitical situation in which big powers are involved and they impose a certain imperative on all countries in the region. And the biggest victims, as you've rightly pointed out, the biggest victims are the Kashmiris. Their crisis, their denial of their humanity, occupation of their lands, this is at the root of the crisis. There can be no peace without a just resolution of the Kashmir crisis. It's been 8 years. They've been denied their right to self-determination. Both India and Pakistan, when they achieve peace, it should mean that it should mean listening to the will of the Kashmiri people. If you achieve a peace, a great power peace that denies the humanity of millions of people who are at the source of the conflict, then this peace will not last. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing that this in India as well. India achieved peace in it through its own in its own rhetoric in 2019 with the suspension of Article 370. They said all is now back to normal. Kashmir is like any normal part of India now, and we don't need to talk about human rights or democracy or any of those difficult concepts when talking about Kashmir. And now we know it's not back to normal. Kashmiris have not accepted India. In fact, India will still shy away from actually holding a referendum because they know what the people would choose. And I think they've also, the Kashmiris, and that's my reading of the situation, that they've also moved beyond Pakistan. I think a separate homeland is what they want. Although Kashmiris can talk about it better on what they want. But the basic thing is that they need to be given the right to choose. This is enshrined in the UN. There's a UN resolution in 1948 that promises self-determination for Kashmiris. And it's almost been 8 years, and it's time to implement international law and respect the will of the Kashmiri people.
Dr. Ali, John, thank you for joining me on Let's Just Talk and teaching us so much. We look forward to continuing these conversations with you in the future.
Pleasure to be here.